This is just a basic introduction to information security. So first off, what is information security? Some of it's kind of obvious. The basic would be protecting information, data, and systems, computer systems, from attackers. So data and information are distinct, I should mention. Data is the actual bits and bytes on your hard drive, and information includes things that you can draw from the data. So sometimes you can get information out of data that is not directly there in data. That gets a little bit more complex, so I'm not going to go into detail there just yet. Areas that this include are protecting the confidentiality of data and information, protecting the integrity of data and computer systems, and ensuring the availability of data in computer systems. So I thought one of the definitions that would be nice to get out up front is the black hat versus white hat. You've probably heard of this. So a black hat is commonly called a hacker. More precisely, they're a criminal attempting to compromise a system. Hacker is kind of an imprecise term because it's been sort of redefined by mostly the media in recent times. A white hat, on the other hand, uses similar techniques called penetration testing to determine a system's weaknesses before it is actually attacked by a black hat. And a gray hat is someone kind of straddling the line of legality. They often break the law and they try to compromise systems, but usually it's not for personal gain. Usually it's like they're just trying to prove to that organization that they've got bad systems, but still not legal. So cryptography is one of the main areas of security, in the sense of it provides an awful lot for you in helping with information security. There are three forms of it. Well, I suppose I should define cryptography itself first. Cryptography is when you substitute in for characters or digits with other characters or digits. Sometimes, in fact, usually there's more than one character replaces a single character. And this is as opposed to a code. This is what's called a cipher, as opposed to a code, which actually replaces entire words. A cipher is a lot easier to implement and store your key, because it's only replacing, you know, 26 letters and a finite number of characters versus attempting to replace an indefinite number of words. So there's three forms of cryptography. The first is symmetric key cryptography, which is where the key must be exchanged between communicating parties. So that's basically, if you've ever had a little program that encrypts to a disk, and you enter a key, like a password usually, and then you decrypt it by using the same password in the same program. That would also be like if you ever, as a kid, made up a cipher. It was certainly a symmetric cipher because you've just got one key. Now, the next thing, which is asymmetric cryptography, was developed in the 70s and allows the two parties to communicate securely without ever having to exchange secret keys. So this is kind of revolutionary because it means that if I want to communicate with you secretly, I don't have to take my key and bring it to you in some secure method. And that's one of the hardest things to deal with, because for security, you end up needing to change your keys regularly, or else it weakens the overall security of the key itself. And as a result, bad things tend to happen. We'll go more into depth into the cryptography issues in general in a future presentation. The third type is hashes, cryptographic hashes to be specific. These are one-way functions that provide a fixed-length output for any input with a really low chance of collision. Now, when I say there's a low chance of collision, that means for any two inputs, it's very likely that there will be different outputs. So basically, if you've ever seen like MD5 or SHA-1 or 256 or any of the SHAs, what this is literally doing is you'll take a file, you'll run a program that takes in this file's input, and it spits out some text for you of a fixed length, so every time it's going to be, say, 50 characters, and you can use that. It'll be the same every time, so you can use that to, say, verify the integrity of the file. You can also use hashes for password storage, but again, we'll leave that, the details of that, to a future presentation. And just a tip, XORing your data and your key only provides secure encryption if the key is the same length of the data and is never reused. And I say that because that's the most common form of encryption that people make that they think that no one else can ever break. So obviously, if the key has to be the same length as of the data and you have to exchange that key because it's a symmetric algorithm, then you might as well just use whatever channel you use to get the key to the other person to to communicate the data. And obviously, it takes twice as much space even if you aren't distributing it to other people. So there's a couple different ways to classify security. The model that I'm most familiar with breaks it down into two categories. The first is integrity. This is concerned with protecting data in the system it resides on from being damaged or tampered with or destroyed in pretty much any manner. This includes dealing with writing but not reading permissions on files. It also has to do with making sure that a user that is not authorized to write to a file, like I said, cannot write to it. So this would be called contaminating a file. So in confidentiality systems, that matters. And of course, that gets to be stuff we need to go on to and into on a separate presentation as well, because it gets kind of in-depth. Confidentiality is concerned with keeping data and information secret and making sure that only those with proper permissions may read the data versus writing the data. And as I described before, information is distinct from data. Are there any questions so far? I've covered a few slides, some of it.
What is part of confidentiality about data and not just about information? Because it seems that integrity would be about data only.
Confidentiality, I do have stand-in for information on there. I may not have said it, but... Integrity is more concerned with data, but I could probably conceive of a certain systems where you define something's integrity, where you are concerned with the information being protected. It gets very detailed very fast, which is why I'm trying to give an overview here, but go ahead.
Let me just restate my question. Why would confidentiality be something that would allow you to be concerned with keeping your data secret? Could you release your data knowing that your information is secret?
That depends on the data.
Okay.
I mean, some data, yes, maybe. But data and information tend to be linked, right? And a lot of times from data, I can draw information. So for example, medical records. I could take groups, and I could use unisons and intersections in clever ways to figure things out about individual records that I'm not supposed to be able to figure out, even if I don't have access to read the names of the people for individual records. I can figure stuff out. So that would be a case of being able to get information from data, even if the data is supposed to be sanitized such that I can put it out there without it being a problem. Does that make sense?
Yeah, to some extent. I can see how it could be applied. I was just, for some reason, putting the word all keeping data.
It's okay. We're going through stuff fast. And some of it's pretty complex, and there's a lot of it I'm doing hand-waving on and saying, we're going to cover this again in the future in more detail. Right now, yes?
I'm still a little confused as far as what exactly that is. Is it more than just, let's say, storing passwords in a way that you maintain a day to day, like setting up the passwords? Do you go outside the realm of personal information?
Well, depending on what you mean by personal information.
But can it be used in, let's say, running certain protocols?
So in the sense of like...
Like to route information, just to communicate?
Well, cryptography is used in communication, some communications protocols.
Okay.
So that's why you have like SSL. That's
okay.
Utilized in cryptography.
Okay.
Does that answer your question?
Kind of, yeah.
Okay.
Okay. And it kind of makes it a little bit more difficult for somebody to get, let's say, data to information.
Can you rephrase that question?
Like, to go beyond, I guess ultimately comes down to this, or the computers.
Yeah.
But the dates are more obscure if it's encrypted.
Yeah. So with encryption, there's a lot of different things I can do when I encrypt something. So, for example, going back to my database example, right?
Yes.
What I was describing would be like if I had encrypted just the identifying information fields, right? But not the entire database. So if I encrypted the entire database, then it would make it, unless you had access to the encrypted database,
okay,
it would make it almost impossible for you to have retrieved that information. So it just depends on what all you encrypt.
Okay.
And that varies from project to project.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just to clarify, and you might mention this later, I don't know, but like HTTPS, it uses asymmetric encryption.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah.
Another way to think about cryptography is it's a scientific means of replacing data with garbage. That's really what it does. It converts data into something.
Well, it converts data into something that appears to be garbage.
Yeah, I mean, well, it is garbage unless you have the particular attribute.
Yeah, specifically, it's not just garbage.
It's scientifically created.
Well, it's garbage that has the appearance of being random.
Yeah.
You want it to look as random as possible so that you can't find patterns in it. So I think your question is, yes, I can encrypt it such that there can be no information drawn from it, usually. But that's a really complex subject, and so if you'll bear with me, in the future we'll go more in-depth in it. But I like your questions, don't get me wrong, because they're going to get me thinking about what I put on a cryptography presentation. Okay, any more questions on this slide? So here are some examples of the different types of classifications. Under the system I just described, a denial of service attack is an integrity attack because it compromises the system, because it makes the system useless. Changing in a field in a database without reading it is an integrity attack. If you did read it, then it would be a confidentiality attack. Stealing credit card records is obviously a confidentiality attack. Intercepting and reading an email is a confidentiality attack. Compromising a system in order to read emails, now that's an integrity attack. An attack can be made up of multiple parts, and each bit can be classified. Each part of the attack, bits and bytes, I know, can be classified in a different way. Does that make sense? Question?
You might want to get to Fair enough.
Denial of service attack then is a attack which basically does what it says. It prevents you from getting access to some service or resource. Something you'll hear about in the news a lot is a DDoS, which is a distributed denial of service attack, which is when you have a bunch of computers that go and they request something from a server, or it could be an individual computer, but usually it's going to be a server, and that takes the computer, that server offline because it's getting too many requests for it to handle.
I'll
give you a better example. Well, because you're thinking in terms of online. Here's another one. Let's say I've got an encrypted file that I need to be able to get access to, and you come in and you change a few bytes. I can no longer decrypt that file successfully.
Okay.
It will fail when I attempt to decrypt it. You've just performed a denial of service attack on them. What? Exactly. It's a broad category.
Right.
It's a very broad category, yeah. And I just wanted to clarify, it's not just online. You can literally just go change an encrypted file and cause problems. Did you want to say
something? And also, like, a more difficult version of that would be if you padlock all the doors to a building set, but someone needs to get bolt cutters to get into the building. You deny everybody the service of that building for that period.
I agree. That's a very good example.
No one needs that.
I spend a lot of time looking at just the computer security side of things, and I'm used to it, so I don't think about making physical world examples, but feel free to chime in with them if you think of them, because they help people get their heads wrapped around it. So shall I go on? So here's an alternative classification of security. It's the CIA triad. It did not come from Langley. It's actually an acronym. It stands for confidentiality, integrity, or both of those. It's basically the same definition as before, except for the third part, which separates out availability from integrity. So availability in this case is just defined as ensuring that a system is available when needed. So again, this would include things like denial of service attacks. Now, are there any questions on this one? I think it's fairly straightforward. I think we pretty much just discussed it all, actually. So here's another one. This one is more directly about the threats. And this is STRIDE. It's a Microsoft acronym, and they've got a whole bunch of stuff about STRIDE out there. This is actually what we use where I work. So the first one is spoofing identity, which is when an attacker impersonates a legitimate user. Two is tampering with data, which is just basically modifying data. Then repudiation, which is when a malicious user can successfully deny responsibility for an attack. This area also concerns itself with ensuring that data is genuine and cannot be repudiated by the guy who originated it, which in this case would be like if I submitted a credit card payment to an online service, then I don't want you to be able to say that, no, I didn't actually do that, so I want to have a way to trace back to you that you submitted that. The next one is information disclosure, which is when information or data leaks to unauthorized users. Denial of service, we've discussed that. There are attacks which prevent valid users from using the service. Elevation of privilege is the final one. This is when an unprivileged user gains privileged access that allows them to cause some form of harm. So are there questions on that? Because that was quite a lot there.
So all of those seem to have non-software related implications. None of them are necessarily only
a lot of security is like that. Okay. Probably most, if not all of it, is in some respect. Anything else? That is in fact why I used information security versus, say, cybersecurity. And I think everybody saw on the flyers, I put that in there, but information security is broader. And I wanted it to be so. We'll probably mostly be focused on dealing with security for computer systems, but all the same.
At some point, it would probably be interesting to get a presentation on social engineering. Because a lot of people aren't too put off by happy curiosity. Oh, how does this work? And not know that people went ahead and
well, it's more than just that. I mean, this gets mentioned a little bit down the road, so we'll come back to that. But I agree, that would be an excellent area of research. Go get to it. All right, so I'll move on. So the next area, as you might see from the topics there, I'm starting to break down by attacks versus defenses. So the first area of attacks that I'm going to cover is malware. Malware is just an abbreviation for malicious software, so it covers quite a broad number of things. So the first on my list is viruses. These are self-replicating programs that are capable of spreading from one computer to another, usually through some form of human aid. So when I say human aid, I mean usually this requires, say, me to take a disk from one computer and put it in another. They aren't capable of jumping from one part of the network to another. Now, the next item on the list is actually a type of virus that is capable of doing that. It's called a worm. This is a type of virus that's capable of spreading from computer to computer without human aid. So there's a couple ways this can happen. One is email worms. Those are the worms that go, they integrate into your inbox, and they get your address, your email client, I'm sorry, they get into your address book, and they send all your friends an email that looks like it might actually be coming from you that has something attached. And that attachment is itself. Another way is just through various forms of vulnerabilities. I can think of a couple examples off the top of my head that I can't get into all the detail in because I don't remember it all, but you get a lot of errors, like buffer overflow errors that allow me to connect to your server that you're running. So Microsoft's server, what is it? ISS, I think? No, IIS. It had at one point a buffer overflow error that was really easy to exploit, and I can't remember what it was called, what this form was called, but it got all over the place.
Configure?
No. Configure was more recent than this. Configure was more recent than the book I just read on this a few months ago. So the malware topic, again, it's a very in-depth topic, and right now I'm just trying to do a survey. The next one, the next category is Trojan horses. These are programs that appear to be legitimate, but once they're installed by the user, even if they still appear to be doing what the user thinks they should do, they often have an additional nefarious use. So, say I install a chat client that allows Luke over there to come connect into my computer and to control it. So, that's a problem.
The Trojan horse is if you download aware or anything of a questionable nature like that, a lot of security teams that crack the software will put
extra malicious code in the fusion headers. In my work, what will not offer the private information is something to keep in mind. You have a more rash.
All right. The next category is a rootkit. This is a little bit harder to find because it can kind of go in the other things. In fact, all three of these remaining ones can come from pretty much any of these above categories. So a rootkit is a malware that modifies host operating system with the intent of making itself undetectable. So it's going to go modify at the kernel level so that the kernel can't detect it, or the operating system can't detect it. And when I say the operating system, that includes anything running on it. So antiviruses usually cannot detect rootkits if they are running in the operating system that is infected.
So what do you do?
Well, you generally have, there's some products out there that fix it without rebooting, but generally the best solution is going to be to reboot into another operating system. So for instance, a Linux Live CD is a good way to do it. And of course, there's always the tried and true method of just reinstalling the operating system. That's kind of, that's not quite the nuclear option. The nuclear option involves smashing the hard drive. But anyway. So a backdoor is software, a part of software that allows remote access to the machine. A backdoor is usually going to be something that's just installed with like a Trojan horse or a virus. But there have been cases of legitimate software using backdoors. Usually it's not for malicious access, or it wasn't intended for malicious access. So, for instance, Cisco, I believe, has had accounts on its routers at one point or another that were really easy to get into, and they were backdoors. Similarly, at one point, Windows XP, I think it was, had a backup admin you could get to if you booted into safe mode, and a lot of people didn't know to change the password on that, so that was also a backdoor in a sense. So the next category is botnets. We've mentioned these a little bit. They're networks comprised of compromised computers. So usually it's going to be compromised by some virus or another, and they're controlled by a nefarious entity for activities like DDoS attacks, spam, sometimes just distributed computing of some other variety. These are fairly often in the news. They're not necessarily the mainstream media, but periodically one of these gets taken down, and it's a time for celebration because spam emails tend to go down. So are there any questions on malware before I go to the next slide? Yeah.
The backdoors, I guess you're talking about malware, so it is category of software.
Yeah, I probably should have broken this down a little bit more explicitly. Other things that are included in malware are like spyware, which is sometimes even legitimately installed to monitor what you're doing, and arguably adware, which is installed to irritate the crap out of you.
I was thinking along the lines of backdoors, that's also in hardware as well.
Yeah, but since this is malicious software, we're not going to talk about hardware backdoors now. So another form of attacks, which sometimes are used by by worms, like I mentioned, are exploits. These are things that take advantage of inherent problems in software, firmware, or hardware to gain control or do damage to a system. So a couple of examples are buffer overflows, which is usually just when an array, so like something taking in string input, is passed too much data and memory that is not actually included for this array is overwritten with malicious content. So you can do all sorts of nasty stuff with that. Because, for example, you could insert a jump instruction that took it to some other code you had already managed to insert in the memory. Another one are just operating design flaws, which are things that were something was poorly designed in the operating system and allows somebody to get unauthorized access or to elevate their own privileges on a system. There are more exploits. I'm not as familiar with this area, so I don't have a lot of detail on this right now. Hopefully this is something we'll get into a little bit more in the future, but not tonight. Are there any questions that are fairly general? Because if there's anything technical, I probably don't know how to answer the question.
So you're saying,
what was that?
The backdoor hardware.
Well, if it's an actual backdoor, then yeah, if it was put there intentionally, then I guess it's still an exploit, but it gets into more interesting territory. So here is where we hit on the social engineering. Social engineering is a non-technical approach to gaining access to a system by tricking a legitimate user into granting access to the attacker. This is a relatively common and effective form of attack. A lot of times you can just dress up say a janitor or IT, or I think I read at one point about somebody who dressed up as a fireman and said they were there for an inspection, and you can get into the building that way. Another thing to do, of course, is impersonating a legitimate user. So if you were to say, call up the company and say, hey, I'm such and such, Bob, I've lost my password, can you reset it for me? If they reset it, then you can get access to their system, sometimes even remotely. And then another category is phishing, and these are emails or communications that appear to come from a legitimate source, like, say, your bank, but aren't actually legitimate. And they're usually aimed towards getting credit card details or stuff like that. There are other forms of social engineering. These are just a few examples. So any questions or comments on that? Surely somebody has an amazing story there.
Not a story, but just a question. Why would phishing be considered not?
Well, it is kind of technical, but I'm not, say, taking advantage of an exploit.
Okay.
All I'm doing, I'm making something that looks realistic, and I'm sending it to you to trick you.
Okay.
So I'm not performing some technical wizardry to get this information. I'm not breaking into, say, your browser history or anything like that. I'm just relying on you to fall for it, and it happens all the time. And of course,
it's pretty easy to spot if you know.
It is if you know to look for it, and you know how to look for it.
Okay.
Usually, the trick here is a lot of banks, for instance, will tell you we never ask for these details over email. So as long as you pay attention to things like that, you're good. Now, something that I think would be great that would help reduce phishing is if people used email signatures more often. So if, for instance, when you go to your bank to make your account, they gave you on a flash drive, a little cheap flash drive, their public key, and you take that home and you plug it in. Every email they send to you, you can verify as actually being from your bank. And this is something you can do in the background. Signing keys requires you to enter a password, but verifying a public key, verifying that a key is signed, that can be done in the background. So it'd actually be pretty straightforward, but I don't see that happening very often, unfortunately. So another type of attack is repudiation attacks. These can vary. This is more of something you're usually going to use to aid with other attacks. And this is basically when an attacker covers their track such that no action can be taken by the compromised organization. Whether the action is being able to find them and recover the information or be able to take legal action, there's a number of reasons why you want to be able to trace back. So these can be attacks performed through anonymizers. It can be performed through compromised computers, so they're done indirectly. They can also be done through side channels, which are basically unexpected ways of communicating something else. So an example of a side channel attack is, there's one I thought is really clever, is if you had access to a file that is high level and you change permission bits on it, and then you have as a public user, you're able to go read these permission bits, you can actually communicate out a stream of information. It takes a while, but there's just a simple example. Other side channels that are more common include watching like the voltages used in hardware to determine a key for a cryptographic algorithm, and those have been publicized here and there. I think smart cards are one of the things that are vulnerable to those, but anyway. So another type of attack are physical access. This can go hand in hand with social engineering, but this is just another category of its own in some respects. So basically, physical access is when an attacker has direct access to a system. And this is one of the hardest things to defend against. If I can walk into your first floor server room and take the hard drive out of your server, there's not much you can do to stop me. Now, you can, of course, encrypt the drive, which means they probably can't read it, unless they can recover the encryption keys from memory, which is possible. It's hard, tricky. Another thing would be like keyloggers. They can reach back and plug in the keylogger. There's all sorts of nasty things you can do when you have physical access. So that's one of the things we were mentioning. Physical access is one of the things you really have to think about when you're planning your system, because somebody gets access, most of the time you're screwed. So now we're on to defenses. So back to cryptography. I've split this into two chunks. The first is confidentiality. This was the original use for cryptography. It was obvious to keep your opponent from reading your message. It's just really important if you're, say, attack the hill at dawn, and you don't want your opponent to know this, your enemies to know this, so you would encrypt your message. cryptography dates back thousands of years, and so have cryptanalysts who are the ones who break it. Modern cryptography with a well-selected key should take a long time to crack. This varies. Don't buy into the takes the lifetime of the universe, because you got to remember we're also improving computers all the time. Every few years you have to increase your bit size, basically. AES is the current standard algorithm for symmetric cryptography. That's established by NIST. There was NIST. They had a competition a few years ago, so periodically you will see AES finalist, and usually those ciphers are fairly good as well. Its predecessor that it replaced was DES. Don't use it. You can use what's called triple DES, but if you can avoid using that, you're usually better off. The only reason to use triple DES is if your hardware supports it, and that makes it faster for you than using AES. But triple DES is more expensive because it's literally encrypting the same thing three times. But DES is badly broken at this point because its bit size is too small. So finally, developing your own encryption algorithm is not a task to be undertaken lightly. It requires years of research, testing, as well as a deep understanding of mathematics to prove its security. Accepting an algorithm as secure requires peer review by acknowledged experts in the field. And as a developer, you should never attempt to develop your own algorithm, but just use the current standards. Now, I say that not to discourage you if you're interested in cryptography from going and doing this on your own, but if you're making an application, don't develop your own encryption library. Go use an existing one. Go use an existing standard. Don't try to do it yourself. It's like I said with the XOR encryption. That's what everybody turns to, and they'll always tell you, oh, nobody's ever going to break this, and they're totally wrong. So the next half of cryptography is integrity. In some ciphers, it's possible to detect tampering or errors because the message won't decrypt or decrypt in a form that makes sense. So I won't go into the technical details there because future presentation. In other cases, a hash of the original method is included to detect tampering. Usually this would be called signing a message. You'll usually actually encrypt that hash as well, but anyway. Defenses, another one would be user and file permissions. This is something I'm sure everybody has seen. You can go and, like, even on Windows, you can say that such and such user is the owner of the file. They have the ability to read, write, or execute. Some operating systems also include append, but you don't see that quite as often. So something somewhere has to define how all these file permissions relate. A more complex system will use like a partially ordered set or lattice structures to define the access controls. This is, in my opinion, really interesting, but gets into very, very technical detail. Another way is to literally just make a matrix, you know, make a table to keep track of everything. There are many models existing for implementing permissions as well as maintaining integrity and confidentiality in the system. One of them is the Bell-LaPadula model. This is one of the more famous ones, which is why I mention it here. Secure architecture and coding is another one. Secure architecture is basically when you're trying to ensure, as you're designing a system, you're keeping security in mind. So if I've got two components that communicate over the network, and that information that they're sending needs to be protected, I'm going to make sure that they're encrypted. And I'm going to make sure they're encrypted in an appropriate manner. So this is the stage where you're picking what encryption standards you're going to use, what you're doing a lot of stuff. You're saying how everything interacts. This is where a lot of projects get in trouble, because when they're designing the system, they do not keep security in mind, and then they attempt to basically bolt on security, and life is hard for their poor little security people, and for the customers who then lose data. Secure coding is pretty straightforward. You're following the best practices for security and programming. Some examples of this would be like no dangling pointers, using text-to-text encryption libraries, I mentioned that before. Another area would be like making sure that your arrays, your character arrays, are checking, when they're taking input, they're checked to make sure that that input is not going to overflow that array into the memory that goes into the buffer overflows that we were talking about before. So now I'm going to move into talking about more general rather than technical. At the individual computer level, some things you can do to defend your computer is make sure you have a good antivirus. You need to make sure that it's heuristic, which means that it does not rely on matching exact code of a virus. This is important because a lot of modern viruses, they mutate. There's a variety of different types of mutations. They're really nifty. We'll get into it in the future. Another thing is a firewall. This blocks incoming and outgoing traffic to IP and ports. you can deal with this on a blacklist model, which is where you say specifically you cannot send anything over this IP address to this IP address or from this IP address, and or you cannot use these ports. The other option is whitelist, where you have to explicitly grant the ability to send data over ports and IP or two IPs. Another thing is running as a non-administrative user to prevent malware from getting elevated privileges. A lot of people don't do this on Windows because Windows software has had this nasty tendency over the years to require administrative access to do stuff. There's some things you can do to elevate just one piece of software to administrative access, but all in all, that's just unfortunate the way Windows is set up. Unix systems, it's a little bit more common to see super user not being a regularly used login. You can do a lot of stuff in a default user. Plus, there are ways to easily run something as an administrative user and while continuing to be in non-administrative user mode. Another thing is requiring software to notify and receive permissions before making any changes to the system or other software. So this would mean if I've accidentally got a virus on my system, I would have to explicitly allow it to infect files. Now the thing is this means that every time you install software, you have to explicitly allow stuff. And every time there's an update, you have to explicitly allow it to update. So as with the example I've got, Windows UAC, which is user access control, a lot of people just automatically click yes. So it requires you to be very concerned about security. Potentially, and I imagine this probably is used in these systems, systems that don't change as much and that are very specialized, probably you see this more commonly. So at the network level, there are network firewalls. These just go well with PC firewalls. There are a few more things they can do, but for the most part, it's the same concept. It's just implemented at your gateway into the networks. Generally, you still want to have PC-level firewalls, but they can add an extra layer of defense. Another thing is you can use proxies to prevent direct contact between machines, and you can actually do virus or you can do scanning on the data that's coming into machines. So for instance, if I have an IP proxy, I can check all the incoming data and see if it's got viruses. Another thing is network intrusion systems. These look for suspicious activity on the network and they will alert an administrator. Some of these are like snort, stuff like that. This specifically is an area that hopefully we'll be able to look into in the future. There's been some requests for it already. These are pretty useful if you're trying to run a network, a big network, and track it. You can also literally just have Wireshark up and watch the IP traffic, but if you've got hundreds of users, that's not very feasible. And of course, the final thing is a careful assignment of permissions. So then there's penetration testing. This is also known as ethical hacking, and this is when white hats attempt to find vulnerabilities in a system so that they can be fixed. At the very least, this should catch the obvious errors in a system. It's probably not going to catch everything because hacking is hard. Question?
I get a question about testing.
Sure.
Is that how, like, big systems, or that would just be one thing and they're prepared to be considered?
What pen testing would usually be is the developers have tried to make the system secure, right? And so then you have your pen testers come in, and they see if they can find what they can break.
Okay.
And everything they break, the guys try to go fix again.
Wait, the developers would be non-security guys?
It really is going to depend on the organization. It really is. In where I worked, I wasn't there when we did any pen testing, but there was some pen testing done. But in our company, it probably would have been done by the security team. I believe they've actually moved away from that some because, to be honest with you, if it's a standard thing, if it's like, say, just using a network library, what you really usually want to do is have your developers implement it and put it in their software ahead of time and then have the security team review it and make sure everything was done correctly. And, of course, if there's something special that's more specialized, I mean to say, the security team should be dealing with that as well. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Anything else?
It's sort of the end of a lot of companies don't just do pen testing on the software or the data itself, but they will actually contract outside companies to come in and try to break into the building to deal with stuff, just to make sure that all of the aspects of their facility are secure.
Actually, that's a very good point to make. So you mentioned contract outside companies. Generally, I would say it's better to have an outside contractor involved for your penetration testing, at least your final round. You may do some iterative pen testing within your own company, but if nothing else, you want to have new eyes seeing your system.
Is there something that we've contracted out and we've given them the time to plug it in there, and then try to access the system either physically, either in the network, and you don't know what can happen. So we're actually pretending to be broadcasting into their phone and
is that at least legal? Like,
the trick is to be cleared to do it. You have to have permissions to do it ahead of time. And you're going to want that in written form usually. If you don't, that's when it's gray hat. Assuming you're not doing it for malicious activities, that's when it's gray hat. So there's been actually, periodically you'll see in the news, some security researcher got arrested because he hacked into a system. He didn't do anything bad with the data, but he told the world, usually, that he had found leaks. Sometimes he doesn't even have to do that. So if he just tells the company, sometimes they'll still press charges.
Would let's say people at Microsoft just try to find exploits in their operating system, would that be considered an infringement as well?
If they were actually trying to find and exploit said exploits, yes. If they're just looking at it from, well, here's the code, what do I see that can go wrong? Then no, I wouldn't call that pen testing. Pen testing is going to be usually something you do when the system is live. Not necessarily public live, but live at least on a test bed. So I picked a few areas of current activity, stuff that you'll probably see in the media from time to time. This is by no means everything. One would be cloud computing. Some of this is kind of obvious. Moving everything to remote servers means that there's a single point of failure for total compromise of the system. Basically, when you're doing cloud computing, you're trusting your cloud provider to do everything right. And especially if they're storing sensitive data for a lot of people or organizations, that's a big target. So for instance, you might target Google because they've not only got UAH's email, but they've got probably millions of individuals' emails, plus they've got a huge number of businesses and other universities. So that makes them a big target. Now granted, their security's probably fairly good. I don't have personal knowledge. But, you know, at the very least, I know they're using SSL everywhere they should be. Or at least they appear to be. There's always a potential implementation flaw. Those happen from time to time, but usually not on larger organizations. Most of the time when you see, oops, somebody didn't generate their keys properly, usually that's referring to, say, a router that's being sold. There's been a lot of issues with that where there's just this router didn't generate its key correctly, so when you go to access it to configure it, somebody else might be able to figure out your key and get access to that. Usually those aren't all that critical, so, I mean, it's a big deal, but it's not as big a deal as if Google did that. So another area is mobile computing. So Android, I'm sure we regularly see issues in the news with malicious applications. You hear the panic periodically. And, of course, something happens on iPhones fairly frequently lately, it seems like. It's not just, like, malicious apps that are involved here, but, for instance, can someone track me on my phone? The answer is usually yes, but not always just anyone. So it's a big area. It's got a lot of important things because people carry their phones with them everywhere. I mean, mine's sitting right here recording for me because it's a lovely multi-purpose device. I have the GPS and everything turned off, but a lot of people don't. If you geotag your photos, then somebody might be able to figure out where you live. There was an issue with one of the Mythbusters guys. Somebody was able to, I believe, break into his house because they knew where he lived because he had geotagged fake photos. So there's a tremendous number of issues that comes with carrying computers around in your pocket.
One of your mom got arrested because his girlfriend posted the pictures in his home.
I think I remember reading about that. So another area of current activity is encryption. Encryption has always been a battle between attackers trying to read the messages and between defenders trying to keep them hidden. Recent times between AES and RSA and, you know, the other public-private key algorithms, we've seen that the defenders are doing better than they used to be, but whether this stays the same or not is an interesting question. If you go back through history, you'll see thousands of years where, at most, an encryption algorithm will last about 200 years. The best was, I believe it's pronounced Vignier cipher, invented in, I think, the 1500s, broken in the 1800s, originally by Charles Babbage, actually. Hopefully everybody knows who he is. Charles Babbage?
Yeah.
He's a guy who invented the analytical indifference engines. He was a British guy from the 19th century, really smart, really eccentric. He hated, for instance, street musicians and tried to get them banned. But really interesting guy, worth going and looking up. So I have a little bit of suggested reading for people who are interested. My first area is in encryption. I really like encryption, so that's why I gave it a separate area. The code book, that's really good if you are interested in just getting an overview of cryptography. It doesn't go into all that many details, but it's a great introduction if you've not encountered cryptography much. Applied cryptography, this is pretty much a standard thing you hear from everyone. I haven't actually had time to read this yet, all the way through. I've read parts of it. And I should mention, Bruce Schneier is one of those people whose name, if you get into security, you're going to see his name come up a lot. Coursera's Introduction to Cryptography course, this isn't actually reading. Coursera is a online education. They have a cryptography course that is actually very well taught. I took it about a year ago now. A lot of what I picked up from there. Hopefully I'll be able to take the second half of it come this spring, but just depends on how time goes. But I highly recommend that course. Unless things have changed really recently, it's still free. They have homework and tests that you can evaluate yourself with, and they will give you a lovely little certificate that says you have completed it, but doesn't actually count for credit, so you know. But it looks nice on a resume. At least you've got some experience, right? So for general security, there's The Art of Computer Virus Research and Defense. This is a really good book. It's written by one of the lead researchers at Symantec. He wrote his own antivirus in the 90s, might have been 80s. Basically, this is really interesting. It was written in 2006, so it doesn't have the absolute most up-to-date viruses in it. It has no code, actually. But this is a really good book for getting an introduction to malware, and it's quite fascinating. Computer Security by Dieter Goldman. I'm guessing I said that right, but I could be wrong. I've read about half this book. I can say it's also a fairly good introduction. You're going to need to know some discrete mathematics ahead of time. So here at UAH, if you've taken CS214, you're probably set. It's an interesting read, and it covers a lot of general security topics. The Cryptogram Newsletters by Bruce Schneier again. These are good to follow events that are going on in security, and he does talk about stuff. It's a good place to learn some of the security mindset from. And finally, there's the Security Now podcast, and there's a couple websites that you can find information about from this podcast as well. This isn't perfect because it's definitely aimed towards the lowest common denominator, and sometimes things come up on there that I would strongly disagree with, especially when it comes to passwords. It's still a good resource. Again, this is good to keep you up on what's going on in security, plus he periodically will do series on topics in security.